Chapter 30. What Lurks in the Night. Beach. Ursula Vance's every sense probed for warnings, and every muscle was poised to act. He felt more alive at such moments than at any other time, and he honestly knew that these moments made his chosen profession the only one he wanted. He felt alive in a sense that he knew Gethin Driftwich never experienced. The Nivac spy crouched next to the rock face, as if making himself small would provide safety. Tonight was the appointed night communicated by the hand-delivered message to Driftwich from the Narthani sloop. Havant pulled out a pocket watch, the only one of its type he had seen during his time posing as a Keel and Semaphore station assistant in Kernford. He had brought it with him when he inserted into Keelan, then buried it along with other items that he didn't want found in his possession. They hadn't envisioned a specific use for the watch, but he and Hizair had planned for contingencies, such as needing accurate time at some unknown future date, like tonight. By prior agreement, they had synchronized the watch to the first hour bell of Keelan Abbey's. The Keelanders remained unaware that the effort to keep their abbeys on the same time worked to the Narthani's advantage on nights like this. Havant and the sloop offshore could hear the Salford Abbey bell and ensure synchronization. Havant held the watch next to the lantern and partly lifted the flap that allowed signaling to the sloop, with the other three sides of the lantern painted black. It was time.
All right, Driftwich. Send it,
Havant said. He could have sent the message himself, but he wanted his nervous colleague to be involved. Doing nothing but crouching would only increase the man's trepidations about what they were going to attempt. Driftwich sent a single word, go, followed by a string of numbers that Havant gave him. Only he and the sloop captain knew that the numbers confirmed it was Havant sending the message. Three spaced flashes of a lantern came within a minute. They couldn't see the sloop in the darkness, but the flashes came from where the ship should be. The message sent, they left the hidden signaling position and followed a narrow game trail down to the beach. Then they waited. Havant didn't check the time again, but his innate sense of passing time could not have been more than 2 minutes off when a longboat appeared, riding in on white surf. They could barely make out movement, and then men dressed in black jumped into the water. Several raced to shore, bypassing Havant and Driftwich and setting up a perimeter. The rest of the men pulled the boat ashore. A figure in black walked up to Havant, intuitively ignoring the Nivaxian.
Havant?
Yes.
Havant answered.
And you are?
Ursul. Captain. Are we a go for the mission?
Everything is set, Captain Ursul. Gather your men. We'll have to hike a mile to where we left two wagons that will take us all to Kernford, the Keelan capital. Travel will be only at night.
It will take 2 days. And I've selected a site where I believe we can stay during daylight tomorrow. But we'll need to move quickly to make the overnight sight before light.
Havant looked toward the longboat. He could see several men standing with the boat, none of them carrying weapons or packs.
I assume the Navy men will take the boat back to the ship.
Boats, corrected Ursul, as a second boat beached. The seas are high enough that the sloop captain didn't want to overload one boat, and he said they'd need 6 rowers.
How many men do you have? Havant inquired.
20, including myself, as planned.
We'll be ready to move out shortly.
Seconds. Twynor Madoff wasn't supposed to be roaming the woods this far from home, and his father would have been furious if he'd caught his son disobeying. But not being caught was what made it fun. Besides, only in the thickest forest with heavy undergrowth did the adult, flat-footed Mervor come out of its burrow and forage for insects. The Anyarian avian was a delicacy. Once the feathers were removed and the flightless Mervor roasted, the canvas sack over his back could hold up to 4 of the creatures all Twinar's 8-year-old body could carry. If he could catch even one, his father might scold him, but nothing worse. And should the hunt yield 3 or 4, the family might sell 1 or 2 at the village market for a price equal to several days' wages for a skilled craftsman. "Shh," cautioned the sentry as Usul crept near. They had pushed the horses to exhaustion to reach the site Havant selected for them to wait out the daylight hours before continuing to Kernford. Most of the men slept in the dilapidated barn a mile off the Salford-Kernford road. One of the 4 sentries had roused Usul and led him 100 yards into the woods.
"There's someone nearby. I know it's not an animal, since there was a clank of metal to metal. Whoever it is, they're moving carefully."
Both men froze at the sound of a branch breaking.
"Damnation,"
Twanor cursed to himself.
"What an oaf. How do I expect to sneak up on one of them tasty Mervors if I clop around?"
He listened, not moving, breathing slowly and carefully. Despite their name, the word stealthy could have been invented for the flat-footed Mervor. Twinor had once seen one cross a glade covered in dry leaves and twigs without disturbing whatever it stepped on or eliciting a sound. When combined with feathers mottled in greens and browns, the Mervor was almost invisible. He listened for a minute. 2. The tasty creatures were stupid. If he waited quietly, any Mervor within hearing would eventually forget it had heard something and would continue foraging. 5 minutes of silence satisfied him that no Mervor had heard his misstep, and he shifted the sack and slowly moved again. Usul's hand on the sentry's shoulder tightened its grip. Both men heard rustles of cloth against foliage. Whoever it was had gotten closer. If the person kept the same direction, heading straight for the barn, they would see the wagons or hear the staked horses at any moment. A bush branch moved aside 30 feet away, and a boy carrying a sack stepped around the bush and carefully set the branch back in its original position. The sentry slipped a knife out of its scabbard and looked questioningly at Usul. The strike leader's face appeared stern. With a resigned nod, he released the sentry to silence the boy. Unfortunately, he saw no option. If the boy saw them, and they lost him in the dense woods, an alarm could be raised and jeopardize the entire mission. However, it was only 3 hours before dusk, and the boy might not be missed until it was too late to search the woods. They wouldn't find his body until the next day at the earliest. The boy had his back to them. Usul pulled his hand from the sentry's shoulder. The sentry shifted the knife in his hand, placed the other hand on the ground to help catapult him out from cover when...
"Twinor Madoff, you answer me! I know this is where you go to hunt flat-footed Mervors. You get back to the farm before your father realizes where you've been."
"Oh, mother,"
Twinor moaned.
"Every Mervor within a mile heard you and is already back in its burrow."
Dejected, Twinor turned and trotted toward his mother's voice. Usul had grabbed the sentry at the woman's voice calling out. They heard the boy's disappointed utterance and saw him disappear back in the opposite direction from the barn. They listened as the boy met his mother, her chastising audible until it faded with distance.
"Well," said Usul, "that's one boy who's never going to fully appreciate the rest of his life."
6 miles from Keelan Manor. The stars had faded with the lightning sky when the two wagons left the Salford-Kernford Road, 10 miles south of Kernford. They followed an old track another 4 miles to where it brushed a cluster of rocky hillocks, within which lay a depression 40 yards across where they made camp. They quickly set up tents and lit fires to prepare their first hot meal in 2 days. They extinguished the fires and coals before any smoke became visible in full daylight. Ursel made sure the camp was secure, and his men fed before seeking out Avant, who had sat to one side, dozing, Ursel thought, until his eyes popped open when the captain came within 10 yards.
"Captain," said Avant, acknowledging the strike leader's rank and approach.
"We'll go over the mission now. We need to confirm that I'm in charge."
Ursel knew he had to establish lines of authority right from the beginning. The mission was precarious enough without adding a layer of confused command.
"According to my instruction, you are in charge of the mission's timetable and of providing the information needed about the target. However, I will decide the details of how we make the strike, given the information you provide. You are not in tactical command."
"Understood, Captain," said Avant. "The men are yours. And even if I was so inclined and felt I had the authority, it would make no sense for a stranger to them to assume command. However, up to the point of the actual strike, it's my duty to select time and place."
Ursel nodded.
"Within limits," he said. "I trust that your information will give us a reasonable chance at the headman and a plausible chance to get away. This is not a suicide mission."
Although Havant didn't care whether any of the strike team survived, as long as they killed Hetman Keelan, he understood that the likelihood of success depended on Uso's cooperation and his men's belief they could escape. His own priorities were, in this order, ensuring his own survival, assassinating the Keelan Hetman, making a strike at this Josef Kolsko if possible, and safeguarding the strike team members. Least important was the fate of Driftwich, as long as whatever happened to the Nivaxian didn't impact Avant.
"I believe we can work out any issues, Captain," said Avant. "The one change in the mission that I want to mention right off is in addition to the strike. The original plan was against the Keelan Hetman, obviously because he's considered a focus of resistance. A weakness to my assignment is that I couldn't get detailed updates back to Pretty City. It's only recently that I've uncovered another individual who seems at least as important as the Keelan Hetman, and possibly even more important. The individual is named Josef Kolsko, and apparently has been instrumental in several of our failures. I'm invoking my authority to add him to the mission."
"Now wait," said Ursel. "It's dicey enough to be hitting a hetman in the middle of his clan. We won't have time to race around more sites. I don't care how important you think this Kolsko is.
Fortunately, Kolsko lives only a half mile from the hetman," Avant said. "It turns out he's married to the hetman's daughter. I'm intimately familiar with both residences, and we should be able to make a pass at Kolsko after finishing with the hetman, since the exit route I've planned goes near the Kolsko house. If we miss him, there'll be no time lost. We'll just keep going."
Ursel's expression told Avant the strike leader was dubious, but he hadn't outright rejected the proposed addition to the mission.
"Let's go over the plan I've come up with, Captain. You can evaluate whether the addition promotes any unnecessary risk, but I think your genuine doubts can be assuaged."
Avant pulled out several sheets of paper, and the two men moved to a blanket spread out on the ground. He laid the sheet side by side. The first sheet was a diagram with squares, rectangles, lines, words, and symbols.
"Here's the layout of the hetman's house. They call it the manor.
The drive runs about 80 yards from the road to the front of the manor, here. Hervant continued with a description of everything marked on the diagram. There are 4 regular guards for the headman. 2 of them have fixed positions, 1 at the entrance of the drive and 1 on the front veranda.
Only 4 guards,
interrupted Usul.
You're sure? I would have expected at least 10.
I had figured that unknown number to be the biggest obstacle.
My men are good, but for the attack to go forward, I was prepared to cancel if the opposition strength made it seem impossible. Only 4 guards.
I may start to think this might actually work.
4, confirmed Hervant.
I've been to the manor dozens of times. Even 4 is something new. Until a few months ago, there were no guards. Only whatever working staff happened to be around.
Stupid of them, said Usul. But that's fine with me. You mentioned 2 of the guards are stationary. What of the other 2?
The times I've been at the manor when the headman was at home, I couldn't detect a pattern to the other 2 guards. Often one was at the rear of the manor, and the other one walks the grounds, though it's not consistent.
No matter, said Usul. With only 4 guards, we should go through them without hardly slowing.
I assume they were picked for fighting ability, but so were my men, and we'll outnumber them 5-1.
Hervant pointed again to the manor house. The obvious problem is that we can only attack when we're confident the headman is at home. Fortuitously, the headman's family keeps a rigid evening meal schedule. Within 10 minutes of the Kernford main abbey ringing for 20th bell, the family is in the dining room. Hervant had pulled a diagram of the manor to the top of the sheets. Here it is, to the left of the main entrance, down a hall. The only 2 exits from the dining room, besides windows, lead to the kitchen and the great room. You'll have to account for the windows. We wouldn't want to get this far and end up letting him slip away.
Besides the 4 guards, who else can we expect to be there?
Asked Usul. Just the immediate family servants. The headman, his wife, 3 daughters, ages about 12-20 years, 3 servant women, and a teenage boy around 15 years. It's not uncommon for the headman to have guests, but we can't predict who else might be there the night we attack. If there are guests, the number should be small, usually couples or families, so they shouldn't present a threat to your men.
I agree, to a point, said Usul.
The other factor is you can't be sure the headman will even be at the manor when we're ready to strike. You'll have to confirm the headman is on site before I'll commit my men. We're not here to kill indiscriminately.
Hervant didn't argue. Not that he had qualms about non-combatant deaths, but if the headman disappointed them by his absence, there was no need to risk exposing himself. He would then send the strike team and Driftwich back to Salford as fast as they could travel. One of Usul's men had already planned to drive the 2nd wagon on the return trip. Tomorrow night was the assigned date. Hervant would make a final scout of Keelan Manor and attempt to confirm the headman's plans for the evening. For now, he needed to get back to Kernford to sleep and make final plans. He would arrive at the semaphore at dawn the next morning. If it turned out to be an average day, several messages should come in for the headman, and Hervant would establish whether the headman would be home that night.